Paul was chosen at Challenger Camp to present a compass check later in the camp. And after he gave the compass check, I said, well, Paul, why don't you take and boil that down into a sermonette and bring it back and share it with us when he came home. So I appreciated that he was willing to do that and share it with us. You know, it almost sounds like, okay, you take rock climbing and you make up a bunch of analogies and then you bring it to church. But the fact is, it's very, very real. And the presentations we're making at Challenger Camp are very much based on endurance, you know, perseverance, holding on, not falling away. And I mean, they're very much based on, there's a body of scripture that fits itself very naturally to that. I'm sorry that I don't have the ability on up in Post Falls or on the internet to, I'm hanging a t-shirt up on the end of the lectern here, and it's the shirt that we wore at the camp. It's a picture of a pinnacle, Hitchcock pinnacle, that was kind of the signature climb. And we have here Andrew Beatty climbing on it. It's a fairly technical climb on the side he's on. There's an overhang, and he's hooking himself over that and pushing himself up. I'll mention it a little bit later. But there's another climb that is on another adjoining face of this very same picture that I'm portraying. A pinnacle that's about 45 feet tall. The top of it is maybe 6 by 8 feet, and there are climbs going up the sides. And the goal at camp was to develop your skills enough so that you could climb the pinnacle and get to the top and have your picture taken as the reward effectively that you could bring back home. Now, we had 13 climbers and 10 staff, and Paul said himself, Luke and Christina Crane. Weather was nearly perfect. In fact, there was a heat wave. Last year, there was a cold wave. We almost froze to death at times last year. This year it was in the 70s, almost every single day while we were climbing, which was unbelievable. It was cool at night, which is fine, because we'd build a great big fire in one of the fire pits and sit around for our Christian leadership discussions in the evening, and also to sit there and fellowship in the evening, but no rain, absolutely no rain. It was absolutely perfect in that sense. It was basically perfect in another sense, as it has been for 2 years running. Imagine a group of individuals, say 25 individuals, together for a week, never a single problem ever. No stresses interpersonally, no disagreements, no disputes. If help was needed and someone says, well, we don't have enough help today setting up for dinner, more than one person would jump up and run to go help set up, literally. It wasn't like you had to wait, oh, come on now, somebody please help. Literally, three or four would jump and run to try to help out. It was just an attitude that was there. Everybody worked at their own pace, but encouraged each other, worked as a team. There was only one individual that wasn't able to be certified. What we do is we train the climbers to do all of the system, to climb, to belay, and to be able to teach somebody else to do the same thing. There was only one individual that we were not able to certify because of a problem with just a hand motion or a little bit of a repetition. And when the individual was notified that we simply couldn't certify him in that way, he still remained positive and focused. He climbed. There was no ostracizing. There was no reason to. It was a team. Sometimes every single member can't do every single task. And I was so pleased to watch an individual whose desire was to be completely through the program and certified, unable to finish the task, and to look at it and say, okay, hopefully I will be able to come back next year. But the attitude and the approach, the positive approach, the continuing to climb and be a part of the team was completely in focus. There was never one little tiny problem of any kind. In fact, for 2 years running, that's how that campus functioned. I thought it was incredible. Michael Lisa Capo, James Capo's daughter, one of them, made an observation toward the beginning of camp in terms of climbing and what our focus was, what the purpose of climbing was. And we looked at what she said, and it was like a little light bulb went on in my own mind. But she says, you know, the purpose of climbing is to make all holds positive. Well, for a climber, when you understand what that means, we have hand holds that we call bombers. You can hang on them. In other words, they're bomb-proof. You can hang and put your whole body weight, and you can hang on them as long as you're in condition fairly easily. But most handholds, as you advance your climbing, you have to adjust your weight. Sometimes it would be like a door jam. If you lean to one side or the other, you can put your weight on it. But you can't just put your weight on it straight up on the side. And so the rock handholds become the same way. The harder and the more technical the climb, the more difficult it is to hang on to the rock. And so the whole goal of climbing is to find a way to make that hold positive. If it's positive, you can hang on. You can do an undercling. You can hang to the side. You can crimp or pinch it. There are climbs sometimes where literally you will crimp your fingers, put your thumb over the top, and hang on your fingernails, digging into a little grain in the rock where you have placed your fingertips. I'm just now getting the actual fingerprints back on my fingers. They were all polished smooth. You know, I don't want to let it out, but if there's any bank robbers out there, you know, just hang on those rocks for about 2 weeks, and they'll never catch you, at least by your prints. They are gone. We literally climbed until we bled. As you know, I read about this in books. People say, well, I climbed until I bled. Well, yeah, and their hands were tough because they do it for a living. Well, my hands are soft, so it takes about 5 minutes on the rocks, but it was amazing that you literally, over the time, you're taping your hands, you're climbing, you continue on, you do fine. But it does take everything you've got. But I looked at a few scriptures. I'm not going to turn to these because they're so familiar to us, but I want you to think of them in terms of that concept of making all holds positive. If in this Christian life, there are certain things that we can hang on, because to us, it is a positive hold in association. We can put our weight on it. Then I do believe we advance ourselves in our Christian calling. Philippians 4. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. You remember when we began to put together scriptures on the topic of encouragement in the Bible studies, and we began to build those in for the index? That's where some of these came from. These are like bombers. Romans 8. All things work together for good. Romans 8 again, if God is for us, who can be against us? Matthew 28, I am with you always, even to the end. So there's certain things that we do. We hang our weight on spiritually. If we're in trouble, if we're discouraged, if we're struggling in some way, we remind ourselves that God said he would always be there. And if he's with us, then indeed, who can be against us? And we hang our weight on those types of things. And so as we're going through the climbs in the camp, we're reminding everyone, reminding ourselves, that this is an object lesson. We want to learn to climb. But even more than that, we are there because this is a leadership training opportunity in God's service. That is our purpose. Prior to camp, I was reading a book by John Krakauer. John Krakauer became famous basically when he wrote the book Into Thin Air, about a major mountaineering disaster up on Mount Everest. There were other books that he's written. I have actually used another one in a sermon, Into the Wild, about the young man who went up into Alaska, into the wilderness. That was another one of his books. And I was reading the third one that I had taken down there with me, and he described climbing the Eiger. The Eiger is a very famous mountain in the Swiss Alps. It has a 6,000-foot face of rock. And at different times of the year, that's rock and ice as the winds come in and melt parts of it, and others run the water down and it freezes. And they climb 6,000 vertical feet on a single face. Again, it is one of the most famous climbs in the world. And John Krakauer made a comment as he was describing what it took to climb that rock face, what it took to climb the ice. And he said, the toughest moves on any climb are mental. Now, you think the toughest moves are physical. He said they're mental. It's the way you look at things, the way you look at yourself. I remember one time being up on the Grand Teton and we were climbing, and because I don't climb much, I'm not always used to the altitude in terms of the perception of this openness in this space. And I remember hanging there on the side of the rock, looking down, 1,000, 2,000 feet, wherever it was, down the side of the mountain. I'm hanging on with my fingers and my toes. And I looked down, and all of a sudden, you could start to see stuff move a little bit. And I just couldn't look anymore. I just wasn't used to it. And so there are times when I've actually had to turn and look away. It's in your mind. If you were on the sidewalk, on a ladder, on the side of your garage with handholds, you wouldn't even think twice. I thought it was interesting. He's describing all of these technical skills, and then he says, the hardest moves, the trickiest things, are all mental. Look at Romans 8 in this context, in verse number 18. Look at what Paul describes as the difficulties of this Christian life. But then the solution is, again, the mental attitude and approach. He says, I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory which shall be revealed in us. You do that in your mind. It's our value system. For the earnest expectation of the creation eagerly waits for the revealing of the sons of God. For the creation was subjected to futility, not willingly, but because of him who subjected it in hope. Because the creation itself will also be delivered from the bondage of corruption into the glorious liberty of the children of God. It says there is hope. He tries to portray as if the creation itself looked forward in hope to being restored and for the corruption and bondage to drop away. We know that the whole creation groans and labors with birth pangs together until now. And not only they, but we also who have the first fruits of the Spirit. Even we ourselves groan within ourselves, eagerly awaiting for the adoption, the redemption of our body. For we were saved in this hope, but hope that is seen is not hope. For why does one still hope for what one sees? When you know that you can do something, and it's easily done, then you don't need hope or faith, you just do it. And Paul is saying, in this life, it are those things that challenge us the most, where we need hope and faith and conviction. And again, that's a mental attitude and approach of trusting God and looking to him in that way. If we hope for what we do not see, then we eagerly wait for it with perseverance. Likewise, the Spirit also helps in our weakness, for we do not know what we should pray for as we ought, but the Spirit itself makes intercession for us with groanings which cannot be uttered. Now he who searches the hearts knows what the mind of the Spirit is, because he makes intercession for the saints according to the will of God. We know that all things work together for good. These are the bomber holds, but it's in the whole context. We know that all things work together for good to those who love God, to those who are called according to his purpose. Down in verse 31, what shall we say to these things? If God is for us, who can be against us? So Paul walks down through, describes some of the agony, the tribulation, the frustrations, the struggles in this life, and says there are things, though, that we hang our faith on that give us security and allow us to advance. Verse 37, he says, in all these things, we are more than conquerors to him who loved us. For I am persuaded that neither death, nor life, nor angels, nor principalities, nor powers, nor things present, nor things to come, height or depth or any other created thing shall be able to separate us from the love of God, which is in Christ Jesus our Lord. Nothing can make us fall spiritually, except we ourselves letting go. I brought with me, and again, this isn't something that is able to be shared over the internet so much, although I did give a picture. This is a picture of the Hitchcock Pinnacle. And I gave a picture to Luke and Christina, so at least up in Post Falls they can look at it afterwards. You won't be able to see the faces, but you can get the scale here. So that's afraid of height Christina Crane standing on top of that pinnacle. And everybody climbed it. And then the picture was taken up top. 45-foot pinnacle on top of a platform, basically close to the highway where you can access it. And it's a great picture. But it is, to me, it gives a lot of statement in terms of what was accomplished. I hope what we did spiritually is as impressive as what it looks like we were doing physically. That's our whole purpose. I think what's interesting, maybe specifically in this way, is Christina being afraid of heights. Why would a person who's afraid of heights take up rock climbing? Why would she do that? Well, maybe to overcome the fear of being afraid of heights. Now, wouldn't it be amazing if those things that we fear unreasonably, unnaturally, in this life, whether it be where we lack faith or where we need to have more hope and focus, if we would actually take on those challenges to overcome them so that we could stand on top. Again, it might sound a little trite. It's not trite. It's the real situation in this flesh. While we were climbing on that pinnacle, an old man came up and began to put on his gear. You say, old man. Okay, how old? How about 82? Is that old? It ought to be old, right? 82-year-old man came up and began to put on his rock climbing gear. And he had a young man climbing with him who went up the route in advance and hooked on up top in order to belay so the older man could come up on the rope. So one led the climb and the other followed. The 82-year-old man was Fred Becky. I am assured that probably nobody listening now knows who Fred Becky is. Fred Becky is one of the most nondescript, unknown, famous people in the rock climbing community in the world. It's a very strange circumstance. Fred Becky began to climb. He soloed his first mountain at the age of 13. He spent basically the last 70 years climbing. He has put up more climbs, more rock climbing routes that were the first climbs. He has done more mountaineering first ascents, probably than anyone else in the entire world. He pioneered routes on Mount Rainier in the 1950s. He was the first one to climb Alaska's Mount Hunter. He was the first one to climb the northwest buttress of Mount McKinley. He has climbed a number of first ascents in the Himalayas. He's climbed in China. He has climbed around the world. If you go into a regional area where there are rock climbing routes and you go through the handbook, you're going to see his name scattered throughout as one of the individuals who put up many of those ascents. He walked up while we were there and began to climb. He climbed up to the top of the pinnacle at age 82. You know, that changed my perspective just a little tiny bit. I didn't feel as old as I thought I was. I told Michelle, I said, you know, when I can't climb what I want, I don't want to climb anything anymore. And she says, you are such a rotten attitude. And I looked at Fred Becky. He's over there. He's climbing right next to me. He's 82 years old, and he's got a little bit of a stoop to him, and he climbed up and went to the top of that. And I thought, well, you know, maybe there is life after 50 after all. Just, you know, at least a few years. Maybe there's just a little bit that's left. I'd like to read you a little bit about him. I looked him up on the internet. It was really interesting to meet him. I called him Mr. Becky, and he looked at me like I was daft or something. Few non-climbers know of Becky. It's an improbable obscurity given that he has made first ascents of more peaks and climbing routes in North America, possibly the world, than anyone else ever has or ever will. The ever will is because once there's a first ascent, somebody else can't make the first ascent the next time. It's been made. And so once the mountains have had climbers on top, then you can't do them again. And that was the point. Probably the never will. There's even a Mount Becky, previously unnamed peak in Alaska's remote Cathedral Mountains, that he and two partners were the first ones to climb in 1996. He's 82 now. He's still doing first ascents in some places. Fred belongs to a community of climbers who don't put a lot of value in the highest. They put more value in the more difficult or the classic climbs. One of his friends mentioned who's climbed with him around the world. Nobody's been more prolific in first ascents than nobody ever will be, because there aren't enough unclimbed mountains left. He's one of a kind in history. Becky's rock star status with young climbers stems from his age-defying, never-ending climbing. This article was written when he was 80, just a couple years back. Never-ending climbing career, also from his books, especially the three-volume, 1,000-page Cascade Alpine Guide. It describes nearly every route on each of the hundreds of peaks in the Cascades north of the Columbia River. He personally put up first many of the routes in the Northern Cascades when those mountains were first being climbed and cataloged. In some European countries, Becky probably would have been knighted and given some generous pension. That's the kind of stature he has in the mountaineering community. It says, with expeditions probing every unexplored recess of the planet and herds of climbers paying $65,000 each to be led up Everest, it seems inconceivable that any virgin peaks or routes could remain. Yet Becky's still searching out and summiting them, as he has done for more than 60 years since he was a Boy Scout in Seattle. His latest unclimbed target is 19,000-foot Jara in China's Western Province, one of China's Western Provinces, where he has been climbing in recent years. Again, this was written when he was 80. He had a peak picked out in China and an expedition that he was trying to organize so that he could, bag one more. It's an absolutely beautiful peak, a gorgeous mountain, he says. And if there's time, there will be lots of other peaks where we can do while we're there. He's planning an Alaska climbing trip in May or June. Since January 1, he's gone rock climbing in California, Arizona, downhill skiing in Utah, cross country ski touring in Sun Valley. Injuries don't seem to slow him down for long. This is where you get to, all right, all the whiners. Michelle surely can use this against me. But his injuries don't seem to slow him down for long. He sprained a foot in a Tucson hotel lobby January the 12th, underwent long postponed hernia surgery at an Olympia hospital on February the 4th. Last September, doctors in Portland drilled two holes in his skull to relieve pressure from a hematoma caused by a head injury in a car crash in June, and I meet him on the Pinnacle out of Tucson there, Hitchcock Pinnacle, climbing up looking for the next climb to come. I thought it was an incredible example of an individual's attitude and approach. I'm not holding him up as a saint. I'm not saying he's righteous in his attitude and approach. I'm saying that he looked at his life in a specific way and made pursuit of it, and he never, ever quit. It just made me look a little bit different at climbing. It made me look a little bit different at, indeed, the years of our life and how they can be spent. And I don't mean just physically. I mean in that greater spiritual sense. Much of what we do in this life comes down to what is our attitude and approach. What is it are we trying to accomplish and do? I had taken some notes with me along to Challenger Camp. This was one article that says the 12 Habits of Highly Successful Survivors. I mentioned it in discussion, and a number of the climbers wanted a presentation made on it, but quite frankly, we simply ran out of time. There just wasn't time to present everything that we took. So I want to share some of this with you, because you don't need the 12 points in your notes. You can simply listen, write down, if you wish, something that is meaningful to you. But the point is this. There are things, there are ways of thinking, there are attitudes and approaches that people who have survived disasters have taken, and it is consistent throughout time. I think it's important for us to look at and understand. It says, in a crisis, some people take charge. Others give up hope. You ever go into depression? You ever face trial or struggle or strife, and you get down to where you feel like there is no hope? It says, in a crisis, some people take charge. Others give up hope. Why? What is the difference between the way we think when we know that we are going to accomplish the task, or when we absolutely are trusting in God, and the way we think when we begin to lose heart? Lawrence Gonzalez studied hundreds of cases to pinpoint the attitudes and strategies of those who refuse to die, those who refuse to give up, those who refuse to just sign off and to go their way. He says, I've been studying accidents for more than 30 years. I wanted to understand why some people perish quickly in survivable circumstances, while others transcend seemingly impossible situations. How many people blew out the door when the church was stressed and people began to teach doctrines that were not true? How many people gave up and became discouraged? How many people just went home? Many. Tens of thousands, it would appear. He says, to my surprise, I found an eerie uniformity in the way people survived the most extreme predicaments, cases I will call deep survival. Is there an extreme period of time that is going to take place before Christ's return? Are indeed we going to face some of that in different ways? Maybe in some cases more than we would like? It's talking about a mentality, a way to survive under stress. Decades and sometimes centuries apart, separated by culture, geography, race, language, and tradition, the most successful survivors exhibit the same patterns of thought and behavior. They go through the same spiritual transformation, speaking again from this article, the author's perspective, in the course of keeping themselves alive. Obviously, my intent would be the spiritual focus. Once you're past the event itself, you're cast away at sea, you're lost in the woods, you have your hand pinned by a boulder in the wild. Now, that's Aaron Ralston. Now, he goes through his examples of survival, and most of these things are books that I have or stories that I've read because they're current. They're very much have been in the climbing community and the adventure community news. It says, then you have embarked on a journey. Here are 12 crucial skills, most of them mental, that history's most remarkable survivors have used to come back from their journey alive. Most of the survival skills are mental. The hardest moves, John Krakauer said, are mental. It's what you process in your mind. First, survivors don't fall into the deadly traps of either denial or immobilizing fear. Some people, in the midst of trial and test, just simply freeze up and don't go forward. Many people who might have escaped the World Trade Center on September the 11th, 2001, died because they waited obediently for help instead of trying to get out on their own. There were people trapped in New Orleans who became trapped indeed because they refused to try to save themselves. They continued to wait for someone to come and rescue them. Others panicked. Panic doesn't necessarily mean screaming or running around. It often means simply doing nothing. Have you ever froze up? Have you ever refused to address a situation that needed to be addressed? Have you ever just sat down in despair and refused to go forward? I think that's incredible. Panic doesn't necessarily mean screaming and running around. Often it means simply doing nothing. Accident investigators of survivable airline crashes often find people dead in their seats with their seatbelt still fastened. Survivors, conversely, admit their condition. I am really in trouble, and I'm going to have to do something about it. I think that's amazingly important. Point two in this case. In the initial crisis, survivors are not ruled by fear. Perfect love casts out all fear. In the initial crisis, survivors are not ruled by fear. Instead, they make use of it. The fear often feels like and turns into anger. Now, let's translate that a little bit. I was on Hitchcock Pinnacle, and the first time I went up, I did what they came to call a Mickelson Meander. A Mickelson Meander means you come up to a hard part in the climb, and you're not advancing the way you like, and so I find another route out of there. I go somewhere else. Now, the problem with that is you're off route. And that could be easier or harder. You have no idea you're off route. So I did one of those meanders, and I went up, and I went left instead of right, and my rope hooked over a little horn of rock over about 10, 12 feet to the side as I ended up, and I had nowhere left to go. And I literally hung there until I had to just push off and do a large pendulum swing and go to the base of the climb and start over. The next time I went up and got up to the point where it was on this picture on the T-shirt where he's hanging from, got above that, and then I went over to the right, and I started up again, and I reached up ahead of me, and it was just absolutely smooth sloping. There were no positive holds, and I just peeled off and went back up into the air. It irritated me about that time. And I absolutely thought through it. I said, I can do it. I had to wait about an hour to get another belayer because of other climbs that were going on and the people we were helping there. And finally, I had opportunity to go back up, and I cleaned. Cleaning is where you completely move through a climb without any faults. I cleaned the most difficult climb I've ever climbed in my life. But it was because I came to the point to where, one, I was intense enough to say, I must do this, I will, indeed, I believe I can. And I simply took it on, and I thought it's interesting here because there's people here, as it says, their fear, their frustration, their struggle turns into an intensity that I will go forward and I will do this thing. There's a commitment there to never quitting, to never laying aside, to never stopping and giving up. And it talks about an attitude. I've experienced that. You've probably experienced that in your life. Survivors quickly organize, set up routines, institute discipline. If you're not praying and studying the way you would like to, and you know you're not praying and studying the way you would like to, and you want to go forward, then you have to actually set up a routine, institute discipline. You have to do something about it. It is not good enough to just live with regret. You can't just live with regret. It is not productive. Survivors are willing to take risks to save themselves and others. They are simultaneously bold and cautious in what they will do. They will not provoke an employer, but they will put God first. They will put their job on the line and offer to work Sundays or Saturday nights or weekends at other times or holidays, whenever the time is free. I thought this is interesting. Survivors take great joy from even their smallest accomplishments. This helps keep motivation high and prevents a lethal plunge into despair. You might be facing a wall. You might be facing something that is apparently or would appear to be something that is over your head and difficulty. And it says, the ones who make it through and who come back home alive, they will celebrate, take joy in even the small accomplishments along the way. They'll rejoice in the fact that they are okay at the moment, that there is beauty, that there is opportunity, that there is hope. They hold on to joy in the midst of trial and struggle. Survivors always do what they do for someone else, even if someone else is thousands of miles away. They feel a commitment to something greater than just their personal circumstance. They have identity to a body, to a family, to a person, to a value or a goal, maybe to God. They have something they are committed to that is greater than themselves. And it gives them better opportunity to survive. Because, you know, if it's just about us, sometimes then we can say, I don't really care. But it's not about us. This life's not about us. This Christian life is not just about us. It's about a calling. Having a commitment to something greater than ourselves increases our chances of survival. It may seem counterintuitive, but even in the worst circumstances, survivors will find something to enjoy. They will look in the midst. When James says, count it all joy, it's not just a concept that we can't understand. It says that those who survive trauma in the worst circumstances find something to enjoy. I've talked to people about their marriage that was in difficult and trial and trouble, and they couldn't see anything whatsoever that was had hope or promise or opportunity or anything at that moment that they could see. They're risking their survival. Even in the worst circumstances, survivors find something that they can have joy in, something that they can look to that has beauty. Survivors are attuned to the wonder of their world, especially in the face of mortal danger. The appreciation of beauty, the feeling of awe, is actually experienced even in the midst of great trial and test. When you read some of the Psalms that David recorded, and you see him being chased by Saul, you see him hiding in caves, you see him, you know, running and at times being without his food or his security or his safety, his men to assist him. And yet you'll see mixed into that praises, rejoicing, thankfulness. Those are things that help us to hold on and to survive. This is interesting. Surrender, it's titled. Only by accepting the idea of death, many survivors say, were they able to continue to fight to live. I think there's application there. We give up this life. We give up the old man. We give up ourselves and our ways, and we submit ourselves unto death in our mind. But there's a process of releasing that that allows us to go forward to a new life, to the new man, to what God would have us to do. They find that in survival circumstance. Believe you will succeed is one of the points. It says, in the latter stages of the journey, the survivor is energized by a deep conviction that he's going to make it. A deep conviction that he will live. We have to have that kind of conviction. What is it? You know, life, I mean, angels, dangers, what in the world is it that can oppose us in such a way that we would fail to believe that God is going to finish the course that he has called us to walk? Survivors know their abilities and do not over or underestimate them. They believe that anything is possible and they act accordingly. Again, they develop an absolute conviction to do whatever it is that they must. Survivors are not easily discouraged by setbacks. When they falter, they pick themselves up and start the entire process over again. They see opportunity in adversity. In the aftermath, survivors learn from and are grateful for the trials they endured. You know what is so important about being grateful for the trials you have endured? It heals your mind. You do not stay embittered by the distress. People will come out of great trials and they will look at what they have learned and gained, that they are a better person as a result. And it heals the mind. A survival experience is an incomparable gift. It will show you who you really are. I thought it was remarkable. There's just a lot of parallels to me in terms of the Christian life and those that have survived great traumas or great circumstances. This life, in various ways, we each struggle for different things at different times. First of the year, a big New Year's resolutions. In the paper, they had comments, you know, a third of all New Year's resolutions have to do with health and fitness. And then it says a third of those don't even survive the first week. Darla was saying on the way down, and I said, are you sure I can say this? She says, you can say it. I said, now, honest, you know, can I say this? She says, you can say this. I said, I don't want people to think I'm insensitive just because I am. I want them to think I'm kind and tender, like I want to be. And Donna said, well, she made a New Year's resolution, not because she worships the New Year, because it's a change, it's a time. So she made a resolution. Her resolution was no more diets. She said that took a big weight off of her mind. She's just never going to diet again. She said, forget it. It's not worth the stress. And I thought, that's interesting. That's the kind of resolution that would be easy to keep, would it not? I mean, a third of the resolutions don't survive the first week. I have a belief that Donna can hang on to that one. Never diet again. Spokesman Review had some articles in there giving some illustrations of the kind of problems that we face. A Burger King triple whopper with cheese is 1,230 calories. Now, go for it. Now, you can apply this to something else, because I don't think any of us, hopefully, have ever had a triple whopper with cheese. 1,230 calories. You would have to go snowshoeing for 4.5 hours to burn off that sandwich. to eat up those calories. Now, how many of us would be snowshoeing for 4.5 hours? I don't think any of us are going to do that. The point is that sometimes change absolutely seems overwhelming. The task seems massive. Our resources at times seem rather limited. And yet again, there are those attitudes and approaches that give us hope for survival. Commitment, dedication, rejoicing in the opportunity that we do have, holding on, going forward. It is absolutely critical that we make all holds positive. It is the only way to climb. If you have a marriage problem, you have to find a way to make that a positive hold in order to go up and through it. You must. We all must. If you have a job problem, if you have a health problem, there has to be something in that that you can rejoice in, that gives you something to hold on to in looking to God and in serving Him in that way. John 16, when Christ was striving to encourage the disciples, John 16 and verse 21, on the one hand, He was saying, look, I'm leaving. Now, that shouldn't be something that would cause a great amount of joy, but because I'm leaving, then I will come again. So if you looked past the immediate trauma of His absence, then you could see that there was a longer-term benefit that would be in place. John 16, verse 21. A woman, when she is in labor, has sorrow because her hour has come. But as soon as she has given birth to the child, she no longer remembers the anguish for joy that a human being has been born into the world. Michelle talks about Megan's birth like, well, she kind of, it was long, but she doesn't remember it that agonizingly, intimately in her mind. And I remember for hours and hours and hours that she sat there and held on to my ears. She hung on the back of my neck and had my face in her face as we counted through every breath. I had a great trauma. You know, she gave birth. Next time we just said, you know, would you give her something in the spine there and kind of just relax her, lay this out a little bit, you know? It says, there's joy in the end that a human being has been born into the world. Therefore, you now have sorrow, but I will see you again, and your heart will rejoice, and your joy no one will take from you. So he said, if you look past the immediate trauma, you're going to see something that will give you joy, and that's joy you can experience now, in the trauma, while it proceeds. You can look past the trial to the promises to come. You can hold on to those. Those are bombers. All things work together for good. God will never leave you nor forsake you. Those are bombers. And you get them now. And in that day you will ask me nothing, most assuredly I say to you that whatever you ask the Father in my name, He will give you. And now, until now, you have asked nothing in my name. Ask, and you will receive, that your joy may be full. So he's talking about the fact that there's something to rejoice in, even then. Verse 32. Indeed, the hour is coming, yes, has now come, that you will be scattered, each to his own, and will leave me alone. And yet I am not alone, because the Father is with me. These things I have spoken to you, that in me you may have peace, in the midst of their struggles and trials, that they would have peace. In the world you have tribulation, but be of good cheer, I have overcome the world. So I did it, and you can follow, because I will be in you. I will give you what you need. So he's leaving, he said it's going to be tough, but he says there's a difference between the flesh being tough and the mind being at peace and in the spirit. There's an attitude and approach that you can have that I will give you, that will give you joy and it will give you peace even as you struggle in this flesh. The hardest way to do a climb is what we call on-site. You walk up, any information about the climb is called data. And a person who wants to do the climb in the hardest possible way will not watch anybody else climb it and won't hang around at the bottom so they hear anything. They will work somewhere else on the mountain and they will come over when it's their time to climb and they will be told where the route is with no instructions and they will get up and climb it then by themselves. Obviously with a rope and a belayer, so But in terms of instructions, they will simply figure it out as they go. It is the hardest way to climb because you don't know where to put your hands and your feet except as you see them with your own eyes, and you do not know what combination of moves it requires to get to the top. We call that on sight. I look at the life of Jesus Christ, and he on-sighted in the flesh. He went first. He walked through it, and then he led back to us and said, I'm going to show you the way. You walk in my steps in this life. He took the hardest possible way. After I had finally cleaned that one climb on Hitchcock Pinnacle, Peter Ekema, he had on-sighted the climb. He had gone up completely fresh and did the entire route on the harder pitch. And so later on, somebody was asking me if I had made the climb. I said, yes. They said, did you clean it? I said, yes. Peter was standing there. He says, yeah, but he took 3 tries. He was letting them know that, yeah, he climbed it, but he watched somebody else. It wasn't as hard as what some of the rest of us had to do. It was a laugh, and we teased each other. It was not in any way competitive in that sense. But it was, again, a reminder. It is easier when somebody else goes first. Christ is the first of the first fruits. He is the firstborn from the grave. He led the way. He made it easier for us. He said, follow me. Do what I have done. Be like me. I went first. 1 Peter, chapter 1, portrays this, I think, very clearly in verse 13. Talks about this Christian life, some of the struggles that we face, what it takes to go through that, but who it is that we follow. 1 Peter 1, verse 13. Gird up the loins of your mind. To the loins of your mind. It says, be right in your mind. Have a right attitude and approach. Be sober. Rest your hope fully upon the grace that is brought to you at the revelation of Jesus Christ. As obedient children, not conforming yourselves to the former lusts as in your ignorance, but as he who called you is holy, you also be holy in your conduct. Do it the way Christ did it, because Christ is going to live in you. Follow him. As I don't know if it was the Marines or the Army that always said, follow me. Well, Christ says that, follow me. Chapter 2, verse 1. Lay aside all malice, all guile, hypocrisy, envy, and all evil speaking. Just think of that as an incredibly tough, highly rated climb. And yet God says to lay aside all of these things. As newborn babes, desire the pure milk of the word that you may grow thereby, if indeed you have tasted that the Lord is gracious. If you have tasted, in that sense, Jesus Christ, if you know what it's like to be like him, then that should be enough to work in our mind to give us stronger focus. Verse number 9. You are a chosen generation. We go to Challenger 2 camp, and I tell the young adults who are in the camp that you are a special group of people. And you say, well, you shouldn't be telling them that because we're all special. Fine, we're all special. But these are individuals who've taken the time and the money and the commitment. It costs money to fly into Tucson, Arizona. It's not a major airport. It takes a few switches on the planes. You're going to put out a chunk of change. You're going to take your time and energy. But you know who is there, and I described it last year. Bonnie Turner was there. Bonnie Turner's been to ABC. Bonnie Turner spent 2 years in Thailand. Bonnie Turner is working to become a nurse. She is finishing her training. She has been to Challenger program twice on my staff in rock climbing. And she's sitting there in Challenger 2 as a young adult saying, train me to be a leader among God's people. I think that's an incredible commitment. Everybody can't be off jetting around the world and doing different things. But I'm going to tell you what she did a sacrifice, not because it was simply handed to her. And so when I look at the people who are there, and I say, many of you are already friends together. You know, in this case, Luke and Christine and Paul went down, and I said, look, network with each other, be in contact with each other, and as you go through your service in the church, remember each other to strengthen one another in the service that you do. Because you're dealing with people that are motivated, that are focused, that are desiring to serve God in a stronger way. Those are the people you want to associate with. You want to hang on to each other to be strengthened in that way. That's an important process, who we have our friends with. That doesn't mean we can't be friends to many others, or even friends if possible to all. That's not the point. But there are those who are more tightly focused, and they can strengthen and encourage each other in their service. Those are important relationships. And I tell them, you're special. Hold on to what you have. We want to continue to push you forward in this way. It is a great blessing and opportunity. Going back here, if I can find where I was, chapter 2, okay, verse 9. You're a chosen generation. We're talking here about the entire church as being special, called of God into his service, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, his own special people, that you may proclaim the praises of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light, who once were not a people, but are now the people of God, who had not obtained mercy, but now have obtained mercy. Verse 13, therefore, submit yourself to every ordinance of man for the Lord's sake. Be a good citizen. Be a contributing member of the society where we live. For the Lord's sake, whether to the king as supreme or to governors as those who are set by him for the punishment of evildoers and for the praise of those who do good. For this is the will of God, that by doing good, by doing something in contribution to someone else. Remember, survivors survive for someone else. They hold on to an obligation, a duty, a focus on something bigger than themselves, and part of what causes them to survive is the contribution they know that they must make. If it was just up to us, I have read accounts of people who came very close to drowning, and as you struggle harder and harder and the body becomes more and more tired, the time comes when you begin to look at the water as your friend instead of your enemy. And you begin to look at drowning as a friend because it will give you peace. It's not the kind of peace in this Christian life that we desire. It is peace because then the physical struggle is over. It is not a matter of continuing their commitment. It is a matter of simply letting go, of falling and letting go. And so, there has to be something that we hold on to greater than ourselves, that we will do for something greater than ourselves, ultimately for God, because of the calling that we have received. Verse 15. For this is the will of God, that by doing good, you may put to silence the ignorance of foolish men. As free, yet not using your liberty as a cloak for vice, but as servants of God. Honor all people. Love the brotherhood. Fear God. Honor the king. Verse 21. For to this you were called, because Christ also suffered for us, leaving us an example that you should follow his steps. He went first. He went up in a sense to climb ahead of us. He showed us where to hang on, what to hang on to, and how to hang on. He says, do it like I did it. Follow me. I think it's just an incredibly motivating focus when we really stop and realize that he went first, and that we then follow by his power and in his stead. As I said, Jesus Christ was the first of the first fruits, the firstborn from the dead. He's the captain of our salvation. He made all the holds positive. And we are to follow in his steps. It's a great blessing and opportunity, as even Paul said, even to suffer for Jesus Christ. But it's because we rejoice in our calling, and we rejoice and we have hope in, we look to the kingdom to come. I hope there is opportunity to watch the many younger people in the congregations to develop to contribute, to serve. Many of us have served in the church for 10, 20, 30, 40 years. And some of the younger people coming along have maybe grown up in the church. I don't want Megan and Derek to have to come out of the world. I want Megan and Derek, Michelle and I want Megan and Derek to stay in the body as such, within that confine of what truth and service and commitment truly is. Let the struggles that we face be the struggles that others put on us, not the struggles that we put ourselves into as well. But there is a great opportunity, but we must look at life from a positive perspective. We must take the troubles and trials that we face, and we must find positive holds in their midst. We must make all holds positive. And then indeed we will be able to climb in this life and fulfill God's purpose according to His will.